It's my sense that we're hearing a little less about Iraq these days. For years, I've been angered by the amount of attention and consciousness, to say nothing of the money and the lives, that this illegal, unprovoked invasion and occupation has taken. But now I'm pretty sure that we're hearing less is not because things are necessarily better, but because Americans are weary. We're also hearing a new round of good news. Casualties and attacks are down. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is fading. The surge may be working. We also continue to hear the inevitable chaotic bloodbath that will follow if we withdraw. The Democrats took over Congress a year ago with a mandate to end the war. Now it seems pretty clear they're not going to risk much to do anything meaningful until after the next election, a year from now. So what's really going on in Iraq? And what can we do about it? Here in Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. In late 2003, weary of the overall failure of the U.S. media to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq, for the Iraqi people and U.S. soldiers, Dar Jamil, an independent journalist from Anchorage, Alaska, went to Iraq to report on the war himself. His dispatches were quickly recognized as an important media resource, and he's now writing for the Interpress Service, the Asia Times, many other outlets. His reports have also been published with The Nation, The Sunday Herald, Islam Online, The Guardian, Foreign Policy in Focus, and the UK's Independent, to name a few. On radio, as well as television, he reports for Democracy Now!, the BBC, and numerous other stations around the globe, and is a special correspondent for Flashpoints. Dar Jamil has spent a total of about 8 months in occupied Iraq as one of only a few independent U.S. journalists in the country. In the Mideast, he's also reported from Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. His first book was recently published called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Welcome, Dar Jamil, again to KPFK and Free Forum.
Good to be with you again, Terry. Thank you.
As you may know, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work. So let's go back to that moment in 2003. What were you doing and what propelled you to head to Iraq?
I was living in Anchorage, Alaska. I was spending my summers working in the mountains, both as a guide and then later on as a volunteer rescue ranger with the National Park Service up on the mountain. And then in the off season, I was doing social work and a little bit of freelance journalism. And similar to kind of the mood in the country today, where people are outraged, don't really know what to do. Here's this ongoing catastrophic occupation. It was kind of a similar situation at the time during the buildup where, you know, I was sitting there, watch this administration sell these lies to the people, only possible with the complicity of the corporate media. And I was completely outraged. And as a writer, as someone who values journalism, and I think it has a critical, critical place in any healthy society, certainly if we're going to pretend that we live in a democracy, we need a healthy, vibrant, active media holding the centers of power accountable for what they're doing or what they're going to do. And instead of that, I saw basically a mainstream media that was doing what veteran journalist John Pilger has called it as propaganda disguised as journalism. You know, Judith Miller's stories in the New York Times are probably the best example of that. So the short version of the story is that I was completely outraged and sickened by this and decided one thing I could do was to go into Iraq once the occupation started and see what was happening and start writing about it myself.
Now, it's one thing to say I saw something I could do, but how did you do it?
I basically used the internet. That kind of facilitated the whole trip. I put my email on the listserv of an indie media website, one in Beirut. I don't think it's still functioning, but at the time they had a member in Baghdad writing about the occupation. This, we're talking a few months into the occupation. And so I contacted him and I said, hey, I'm this American citizen. I've never been to the Middle East. I want to come in there and do what you're doing, just to write about what I'm seeing. How do I do it? And so he basically wrote me an email that was kind of a rough sketch, sort of a rough Lonely Planet-esque guide on how to get into Baghdad under occupation. And so he said, go to this hotel in Amman, Jordan. It's about 12 Jordanian dinars a night. From there, you can rent a seat in a car going into Baghdad, go to this hotel in Baghdad, and here's a couple of contacts once you get in. And so I basically just followed his instructions, and they were correct, and I managed to get in. And then once I the key is once I started actually going and put myself in Amman and heading in the direction that I felt compelled to go in, that I just continued to meet the right people at the right times, and things just started to work out for me.
And how long did you spend there? And it wasn't all in one particular stay, correct?
Correct. The first trip I went in was November 2003, and I went with a couple of $1,000 and just stayed until the money ran out. So I stayed about 9 weeks. I did not intend to be a journalist. I was just going to write about it, send emails back home to folks about what I saw. I started out sending emails to about 130 friends, mostly in Alaska, about what I saw. And then at the end of the trip, though, I started getting picked up to do some stringing and actually get paid. And then I realized, oh, I can maybe come back and work as a journalist. And I after getting there and meeting the people and tasting the culture and seeing what was happening during the occupation, I really wanted to go back and continue to report. And so that one trip turned into four total, and I ended up spending a total of 8 months in the country.
I'm Terry McNally, and that's the voice of Dar Jamil, independent journalist and author of a new book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. This is KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. So you were there for a total of 8 months, most of it in the early stages of the war, yes?
It was 8 months over the four trips, which was between the time period of November 2003 and February 2005.
What was it like being one of the only unembedded journalists operating the country? And then let's look at it this way. What was different for you and from you than for you and from the corporate embedded journalists?
It's an important question, because for me, I can say that I could go out and go wherever I wanted and report on whatever I wanted to. I wasn't following dictates from an editor at a big outlet, for example, saying, you're going to go report on this and this is how we want the story. Or I certainly didn't embed, so I didn't have the military saying the same thing to me as embedded reporters have to deal with, or determining what I'm going to see and when I'm going to see it and when I'm allowed to film and not allowed to film, et cetera. So that was a big break, working in my favor, in the favor of other independent journalists that were over there at the time as well. We could go out where we want, report exactly what we want and how we want, of course, working with an editor, but had free rein to basically go out on the street and find the stories myself, which is what journalism really is. I mean, we go out and see what's happening and then report it, rather than, okay, here's the orders from the top in corporate telling us this is what we want you to report on.
Yeah,
today.
One thing I can even imagine is you've used the word story a few times. You go out, you see reality, and you go, what is the story here? Otherwise, my guess is that what they're doing, even intending to be accurate, they're saying this is what we think the story is.
Right, which is a direct result of corporate ownership of the media. Like, you know, the example is, well, people back here want to hear more about the Sunni-Shia conflict, so let's get some stories on that. And they would literally send people out, or send Iraqi stringers out if you're the New York Times, to go out and talk with people and then slant the stories in a particular angle. And so, and then that brings in, you know, back to the question of, so what do you get from me and from other independent journalists? And you get the straight story. These are what the people are saying. This is what they feel. This is how they feel about what's happening. This is what's actually going on in the country, rather than taking orders from someone in New York or Washington that think they know what the story is, even though most of those people have never even been to Iraq, sending journalists out with their little marching orders.
Yeah, and what I'm thinking is that even if a journalist, you know, is viewing things accurately, if he's having to fit his into an ongoing narrative that somebody else has already come up with, that just isn't the same as fresh reality. One of the comments that people make about your writing, and I think it's true, is that you talk a lot about mundane stuff.
Right, because this is what the Iraqi people are talking about. I mean, just put yourself, just close your eyes and imagine for a moment that you're in Baghdad. It's this invasion was launched on the heels of 30 years of dictatorship and 12 and a half years of genocidal sanctions. And now 4.5 years into the occupation, or even 8 months into it, during my first reporting from Iraq, people were complaining about, look, there's no gasoline at the pumps. We have these huge gas lines. This has never happened before. We don't have enough electricity now, so we're having to buy generators and then get gasoline for those generators. And then there's the gas lines again. Unemployment's going up. It was 33% during the sanctions, which is about what it was here during the Great Depression. And it's going up even more. I mean, this is what this aside from the security situation, which was degrading rapidly, this is what people were talking about, because you can imagine you're just trying to get through life, trying to figure out a way to work and earn money to buy food and take care of your family and have some electricity and have some basic things that you need. And that's what people want to talk about.
Well, it would seem to me, you know, as you said, put yourself in their place. Even if you just had those problems and were looking for solutions and it wasn't dangerous to walk on the street, it would be something. Like after a natural disaster, water, sanitation, electricity. But here, every problem you're attempting to solve is in the middle of a video game of violence, isn't it?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And I think that's a really good analogy to bring the war home a little bit. Pretend that you're in New Orleans after Katrina hits. There's no water. There's no infrastructure. There's no security. There's no electricity. There's a shortage of potable water for sure and medical attention. And then you're going out and you're wandering around in the flooded streets and you're trying to find basic things that you need just to survive. But you have to negotiate that there's militias and there's U.S.-backed death squads roaming the streets. And I know we kind of have a rough equivalent with the Blackwater guys, the cowboys running around doing their thing, but still that pales in a comparison to Baghdad, where, you know, you're driving down the road and you have no idea if the car right next to you is a car bomb. You have no idea if that checkpoint you're coming up on with plainclothes guys with Kalashnikovs that throw a couple of tires in the streets, you don't know if they're militias or death squads or you don't know what. So you're going to have to do a U-turn and go try to find a different road, and hopefully there won't be another floating checkpoint there. And that's everyday life in Baghdad.
Right. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Dar Jamil, independent journalist, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. You can learn more about Dar's work at, and I'm going to say it and then I'm going to spell it, darjamiliraq.com. 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 You can visit temcnally.podomatic.com or iTunes to see this as a podcast. The Iraq War has been dangerous not just for the people of Iraq, but for journalists. Why was that so especially so? And congratulations for coming back in your health. And the danger for journalists, how does that affect the coverage?
It has been the bloodiest war in history for journalists. Over 300 journalists and media workers have been killed in Iraq. If you listen to Committee to Protect Journalists, they have the total at somewhere around roughly 130, give or take a few. The reality is there's a comprehensive list by a group called the Brussels Tribunal. They list all the names, the dates, the incident of what happened when the person was killed. It's over 300, and not a big surprise. The majority of them are Iraqis or Arab journalists, because they're the ones actually going out on the streets right now and doing the real reporting and going into the hot areas. And as bad as it is for numerous reasons, of course, the militias, the death squads, kidnapping. I mean, today in Baghdad alone, there's 30 people a day being kidnapped. And if you're just at the wrong place at the wrong time, you're going to be one of those. Of course, we don't hear about that because their skin's a little darker than ours, and the corporate media doesn't really give that the same attention. But the reality for journalists is that this has been extremely dangerous from the beginning. Also primarily because the U.S. military has made it so. The Pentagon spokesperson at the beginning of the invasion made it very clear, even saying in the media, look, if you're not embedded with the military, we can't guarantee your safety. We won't guarantee your safety. We look at the beginnings of the invasion itself, the Basra Hotel being shelled by U.S. tanks during the initial invasion. The only people staying there was an Al Jazeera camera crew. The Al Jazeera office in Baghdad on April 8th being bombed by a U.S. warplane, killing Tariq Ayub. On the same day, the Abu Dhabi TV station in Baghdad was shelled by tanks. On the same day, the Palestine Hotel, the journalist hotel, was shelled by U.S. tanks, killing Spanish cameraman Jose Cuso and another Polish journalist. And that trend has continued, where journalists not only are they not being paid attention to or any care being taken to respect their rights and the fact that we're there trying to do our job by the U.S. military. But, of course, that has – in the military is certainly directly responsible for numerous dozens and dozens of deaths of journalists. But then also now we have the security situation that has deteriorated so much that, of course, then we have death squads and the militias and other groups that are also teeing off on journalists as well.
We've talked about the failures of the corporate media, the difficulties of journalism, and so on. What are some of the things you think are the best work that's been done by your colleagues and allies, either in documentary videos or films, like I think of No End in Sight and several others, or in blogs or journals or books, things that you would recommend when people want to get beyond this and get a real sense of what's happening?
There's some really good documentaries coming out now about it. One that was nominated for Best Academy Award last year, Iraq in Fragments by filmmaker James Longley. Excellent, excellent film. There's another one out that's going around to select theaters now. I know it's been in L.A. Hopefully it will come back. It's called Meeting Resistance by Steve Connors and Molly Bingham, two journalists. Steve's a Brit, Molly's an American, that went over into Baghdad in the first year of the occupation and filmed several members of the resistance. And it's basically a documentary that humanizes the resistance. It shows these people. Of course, their faces are blurred, but it's, you know, who are they? Why are they in the resistance? What are their goals? And they sit there and talk to the camera and tell you everything.
Oh, that sounds – I've asked – and I remember actually, come to think of it, when I interviewed you in 2005, I remember I asked you, what is it the resistance wants? I remember the question now. It's coming back to me. I said, you know, Ho Chi Minh had a clear platform as he fought the Americans in Vietnam. Oftentimes that has been the case. I can't, sitting over here, get a feel for what the resistance wants besides – some want an end to the occupation, some seem to want to win their share when it's over, etc. Is there, even now today, is there some sort of sense of a political philosophy or a vision of Iraq that motivates the resistance?
There is, and that film gets into it because many of the people interviewed talk about that, and it is basically what you said, that the primary motivator is they want to kick the occupation forces out of their country, all occupation forces, not just the Americans, not just the Brits, but the Blackwaters, the Al-Qaeda, all occupation forces. And that's why we have now where the U.S. basically could not beat the resistance in Al-Anbar province, and so they've bought them off. They're pumping millions and millions and millions of dollars into these tribal sheikhs so that they can pay their militias and their resistance groups so as they won't attack the Americans. They're arming them, and also because the resistance groups are much more capable and adept at expelling Al-Qaeda from Iraq than the U.S. military. So the military has basically paid them off to do that and to not attack Americans. And that's why troop deaths for now in Al-Anbar are down. It's a ticking time bomb because it's similar to the strategy used in Fallujah after the April 2004 siege failed for the Americans. When they couldn't take the city, they bought off the city. They basically paid all the militants there, gave them money, gave them weapons, gave them ammunition and other supplies, and then stayed out of the city. So for 6 months, there weren't Americans dying in Fallujah. And then look what happened in November. And I think that a similar scenario is occurring in Al-Anbar. But basically, that's what the resistance wants.
So there isn't a post-Hussein, post-U.S. George Washington, Ho Chi Minh, Patrice Lumumba. There isn't, is there?
No, there's not.
I mean, Al-Sadr, I guess, was Chalabi was the U.S.'s choice. Al-Sadr was the next. But there really isn't one, is there?
There's not. No, it's completely decentralized. There's according to the U.S. military, there's minimum of 30 different groups. And I think the number's well up over 100, probably over several hundred. Because according to the U.S. military, the two main motivators for people to join the resistance are, one, money. 70% unemployment in Iraq, infrastructure in shambles, no way to work, but you'd make a lot of money going and joining the resistance.
I didn't know that, by the way.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that. And by the way, if you guys missed it, Dar Jamal just recommended a documentary called Meeting Resistance, which I had seen about briefly. I haven't seen it myself, which you say really gives some feeling for who are they and what do they care about. But you're saying that one of the motivators of joining the resistance is money. Whose money?
Well, the resistance is extremely well funded. We know that first of all, there was already plenty of money in Iraq among certain individuals, and they started preparing for this resistance long before the war was going to be launched. I mean, they knew that Saddam's army wasn't going to repel any military, let alone the U.S. military, the most powerful military apparatus on the planet. And so they started making plans, cashing weapons, putting money away, getting ready, doing training for roadside bombs, etc. But even without that, there's enough money being pumped into Iraq from all the surrounding countries.
Are they all aiming it at specific proxies?
Well, Saudi Arabia, for example, they've made it very, very clear in the past that they are not keen on having a Shia-dominated Iraq. So they've been pumping in money, militants, and weapons from the very beginning and basically have an unlimited budget. I mean, it's an extremely rich country. And they're pumping millions and millions of dollars into Iraq, a similar but not quite as extensive of Jordan, and then certainly many, many other Gulf states. And there's many fighters coming in from these places as
and
well.
And so – and when the U.S. and others – mention Iran, they're accurate. They just don't also mention as much coming from other countries.
Well, they're really not accurate in the way that they mention Iran. They claim that, well, there's these shape charges and there's fighters and there's backing coming in from Iran, and they're accusing the Iranian government by implication. And the reality is there's not one shred of evidence that would prove that the Iranian government is doing any of this militancy inside of Iraq. Are there fighters coming in from Iran? Probably. Are there weapons and ammunition coming in from Iran? Probably. Can you tie it directly to the Iranian government? Absolutely not. But again, it's a situation where if we just, again, look at the U.S. military, how many people they have in their detention facilities. There's an L.A. Times piece, a really well-done L.A. Times piece done less than a few months ago that showed in those U.S. military detention facilities, 45% of the people in there from Saudi Arabia, 0% from Iran.
Right. Something which got news for about 2 days. And then the rhetoric of the government and the rhetoric of the Beltway punditocracy just reverts. Reality only interrupts that rhetoric for brief moments. Do you agree?
I do, and thank heavens that we at least have those brief moments. But such is the power of the corporate media, and then when the state is doing what they're doing, the direct pressure that they're applying on the media and most of the corporate media, with few exceptions, being completely complicit with their propaganda campaigns.
When we look right now at the future, and now I'm sort of saying speak as someone, you know, over here now, and the Democrats, as I mentioned in the introduction, were elected. There was a mandate to get us out of Iraq. It's a year later. I don't even know if there was a way they could have won, but I mean, I certainly think they could have just kept putting things back on his desk and make him be the one that says no, rather than being able to paint them as the ones who blinked and so on. But forget that. What do you think listeners can do that might have some effect between now and the election?
I've basically shied away and really am not encouraging anyone to waste any time, energy, or money in any of the mainstream Democratic so-called presidential candidates. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, they've all already taken total withdrawal from Iraq off. Nobody except Dennis Kucinich are talking about total, complete, unconditional withdrawal.
Okay, so energy expended on a particular candidate doesn't seem to you don't see as any value. Is there anything? And I, you know, I was at a meeting recently where someone said, you know, why weren't there more people in the streets and why wasn't there more coverage on October 27th? And I have to say, the cynic in me says, but millions upon millions were on the street before the invasion. It doesn't make any difference to this president.
Well, I think looking for a one-off demonstration to change anything is really not the way to go. I think sustained, consistent demonstrations over time, like what happened during Vietnam, is key. There's three things that ended Vietnam. One, a very fierce Vietnamese resistance. Two, a very fierce GI resistance movement. And three, a sizable and passionate anti-war movement back here that supported both of those first measures. And we need the same thing now. And so I've been encouraging people to really get behind groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org. They are a budding GI resistance like what we had in Vietnam. They're gaining between 10 and 15 members a week. The fastest growing segment of their population are active duty troops, many of them in Iraq right now. And I've been interviewing soldiers over the last month, active duty guys that have come back from Iraq, telling me that while there's not fraggings and there's not people deliberately disobeying orders in Iraq, basically they're still not following orders. They're going out, for example, and instead of doing search and destroy missions like in Vietnam, they call them search and avoid. So they'll go out on patrol. They're just getting blown up. They know this is not the way they want to go. They don't even want to be there. They don't believe in the mission. Morale is extremely low. So they'll go out and park their Humvees in a field and sit there and phone in every hour and say, yeah, we're still searching the field for weapons caches, and then go back after 12 hours. And the guys I interviewed said, yeah, we were doing that every other day. Everybody's doing that because nobody believes in the mission. Our commanders are sending us out to get get in combat so they get medals and go up the hierarchy in the military. And we're just not going to do that. And I think groups like IVAW play a critical role. They're the spearhead of any anti-war movement that we're going to have here. They have the most legitimacy. And I think when groups like that get support and continue to expand and get more troops on the ground that start to refuse orders, at the end of Vietnam, half the troops on the ground in that country would not follow orders. The military had to pull out. They had no other choice. And I think that's going to be where it's at for this one as well.
Okay, so that's IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, would be the place you'd put the pressure. It always seems to me that it's when the troops and when the students really – I mean, I would think if you want to do something, try to – fire up students because they've got the time and they create the masses. And I think when soldiers and students are against it, eventually it'll end.
I agree with that too. And I'm just talking about one specific thing that's tangible that people could go out and do right now. Go to the website, support them. If you don't have money, just email them, ask them what you can do to help. They definitely need help in many ways. And the most important thing of all that, not even being specific to one organization or another, is get active. Is do something, find any cause. I mean, there's so much going on, whether we talk about nuclear proliferation or climate change. There's so many critical things going on, immigrant rights, healthcare. The main thing is find what is most important to you in your heart and go out there and start moving your legs and doing something about it.
Let me read a quote that I read that basically says, "It was a failure of citizenship of the American people that the Bush cabal was allowed to invade Iraq. Thus, every U.S. citizen who is not doing everything in their power to end this illegal and immoral occupation as quickly as possible is complicit with the war crimes being committed at Iraq on a daily basis."
Yes, I did say that, and it's back here that might sound a little harsh, but when you've been over in Iraq and seen the dead bodies and smelled the dead bodies that have been in unrefrigerated morgues for weeks, and then seen the soldiers and seen how low morale is and the horrible things happening over there, then this has to be stopped. People are dying and suffering every single day. Everyone over there is feeling it, and something has to be done here.
You've been listening to Dar Jamil. Dar is the author of a new book called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. His site is darjamilirak.com, darjamilirak.com. Thank you, Dar Jamil. Keep up your good work.
Great to be here, Terry. Thanks a lot.